This is Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. This week, we explore the life, vision, and unstoppable creative drive of one of the most important writers of the 20th century, Octavia Butler.
She is the foremother, the literary foremother of so many folks who have come after her, and folks have been very vocal about it. Reading Octavia and being inspired by the actual work, by her work ethic, by how she researched things. And so she is literally and figuratively the literary mother of so many folk. Now, there is such a plethora of Black folk, Black women, and non-binary folk writing science fiction and fantasy. It's really exciting. And we have Octavia to thank for it in many ways.
That's Susanna M. Morris. We spend the hour with her talking about her new biography, Positive Obsession, The Life and Times of Octavia E. Butler. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In her biography of the great speculative fiction writer Octavia Butler, Black feminist scholar Susanna Morris reveals how Butler's discipline, political analysis, and upbringing shaped some of the most influential speculative fiction of our time. In our conversation with her, she takes us deep into Butler's remarkable journey, from a shy, neurodivergent girl in Pasadena, California, who read in the kitchen while her mother cleaned white ladies' houses, to the groundbreaking creator of Kindred, Parable of the Sower, Dawn, and so much more. We talk about Butler's lifelong discipline, her fierce political imagination, her early recognition of climate collapse and authoritarianism, and the enduring power of speculative fiction to help us reimagine what is possible. Let's listen now. Susanna Morris, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
I just loved this book. It made me so eager to read all of Octavia Butler's books, of which I think I've only read The Parable of the Sower. You begin this book with describing how you reading that book as a teenager changed your life. What about Butler's vision first spoke to you so personally?
Yeah, I begin the book that way because although this is a biography, it's not really a story about me. I feel that oftentimes when people read Octavia's work, they have similar encounters to what I experienced when I first encountered her. So I was a high schooler about 30 years ago. I went to the library. I went to the library every week, and I would read a lot of fantasy and science fiction. But I was beginning to come into kind of a racial consciousness, right? And so I was not seeing myself represented in these texts, and I was kind of moving away from them. And right as that was happening, I go to the library and I see this mass market paperback with a Black woman on the cover in the fantasy and science fiction section. So I was like, wait, what's happening? And when I read the back, you know, I saw that it was about a young girl who was 16, about my age, and she had all of these like really interesting ideas, and she was kind of a badass, and she wanted to save the world. And I thought, I want to read this immediately. And so it set me on a path to being a lifelong Octavia Butler fan. I saw myself reflected in some ways in Lauren Olamina, even though I was not living in 2024, it was like 1996, but there were similarities, right? There were, you know, we're talking about global warming and climate change. Butler was so concerned with designer drugs in the 90s. I mean, it was a very much a reflection of the era in which it was published, and the book comes out in 1993. So that's why I begin there, because that is my introduction to the expansiveness of the genre of speculative fiction.
The title is Positive Obsession, which is such an interesting title because it's something that makes you think, okay, what does that mean? So I'm going to ask you, why did you choose that title?
Yeah, so funny enough, it's the only title this book ever had. This is how I pitched the book as Positive Obsession. And I take the title from an essay that Octavia wrote, also called Positive Obsession. It was originally published under another title in Essence magazine in 1989, and then she published it in her collection of short writings, Blood Child. And so in the essay, it's autobiographical. She's sort of tracing her trajectory as a writer, starting as like a young child, talking about her mother being really influential and sort of offhandedly telling her, "Well, maybe you could be a writer." And so the light bulb goes off above her head, and she's like, "Okay, I'm going to be a writer." And she describes her intense desire to read, write, research, publish as an obsession. She can't stop. Right. But it's a positive obsession. She's not out there harming herself or harming others, right? So she puts that modifier in front of obsession. But even though it didn't, quote unquote, make sense for her to be doing what she was doing in the eyes of society, right? She's born in 1947. She's getting these social cues like you should get married, you should have children, you should get a nice government job or something with their stability, right? She comes from humble roots. Her mother was a domestic. Her grandmother was also a domestic. Her father, before he died in her youth, was a shoeshine man. So she didn't come from a background where she had the capaciousness to be like, I'm gonna go off and find myself and write. She had to sort of do all this physical labor, menial jobs while pursuing her writing. And so that did not make her life easy. It made her life harder, right? Because she didn't have the infrastructure or the resources to be just someone who was sitting around thinking and doing the work of being a writer, right? And so that's why she called it a positive obsession. And because this book is really interested in her intellectual trajectory, what she was interested in reading and writing, that's why I called it a positive obsession.
And she wrote once, forget inspiration, habit is persistence and practice. So she also saw her, incredible hard work. Describe her a little bit. You say that she was neurodivergent. What do you mean by that? In what way was she neurodivergent? She was also divergent in other ways. She was extremely tall for a woman, a bit androgynous, kind of an outsider for a very long time, maybe her whole life in some ways. So describe her a little bit for us. Give us a flavor.
Yeah, so Octavia E. Butler is a complicated was a complicated woman. I use the language of neurodivergence. It's not necessarily the language that she would have heard as she was growing up in the 50s and 60s. She was a self-diagnosed dyslexic, right? So when I say neurodivergent, I mean someone who is on the spectrum of neuroatypical patterns of learning, right? And I want a question that I always say to my students, like, not sure it's actually atypical. I think maybe this might be the norm, that so many of us are on the autism spectrum or have ADHD or learning practices that are considered quote unquote abnormal, right? So that's I'll just put that to the side. But she was a very slow reader and writer. She said she was very grateful to have learned how to read and write at home, that her mother and her grandmother taught her. Because when she got to school, her report cards frequently said things like Estelle, which was her middle name and which she went by with her family and in public until she was basically a writer, published writer. Estelle's a daydreamer. Estelle's not doing her work. She is lazy. These are sort of the things that were being told to her. Whereas we know that if she was really interested in something, she could hyperfixate and she could go down a rabbit hole and do really intense, meticulous research. This is going back to being a young girl, basically, right? School was very difficult for her, trying to juggle all the sort of pieces that require you to be an excellent student in our current system. But that doesn't mean that she wasn't interested in educating herself, right? It's just that her learning styles were at odds with, growing up as a baby boomer in the United States. And as you mentioned, she was divergent in other ways, right? So by the time Octavia was in middle school, she was 6 feet tall, so she was a very tall person. She wasn't super interested in the sort of normative trappings of femininity. You know, she didn't really wear makeup. She kind of kept her hair in a low afro for most of her, pretty much all of her adulthood. Even when that style was no longer as in vogue as it was when she began wearing it in the 60s. She was very shy, extremely introverted. In the beginning of her career, public speaking was just the most terrifying thing for her. So she did things like undergo hypnosis and take public speaking classes so that she, you know, would be able to move through the world with a level of confidence. It was hard won. She was able to do it. So if we go and we watch interviews with her from the 1990s or 2000s, we see a very poised, confident, no-nonsense kind of person, very regal, this deep, melodious voice. And that was her too, but she worked really hard to get there. Yeah.
Yeah, and also so much a part of course, of her identity was her tradition or her being African American. And you have a really vivid scene in this book, Susannah Morris, in Positive Obsession, about a bus ride that she's taking with her mother. Her mother, as you say, was a domestic. And Octavia, as a child, would go with her often to her jobs, sit in the kitchen and read or do her homework, and was very aware of the condescending and abusive treatment, really, that her mother was subjected to by her employers, and would, you know, rage at it inside. And on this, well, tell us about this bus trip and what happened and what was the import of it.
Right. Slight correction. They were in a car, but that's neither here nor there. No, it's okay. You know, she really talks about this moment in the context of trying to be empathetic to other Black folk who have internalized sort of feelings of shame around their ancestry and upbringing. And she's able to be empathetic because she had those same feelings as a young person. She was able to work through them. So, as you just mentioned, she followed her mother, you know, many times to these cleaning jobs. When she didn't have a babysitter, her mother's like, you know, come on, get out of the house. We're going to go over to this person's house. I'm going to clean, and then we'll come back home. And in one of these instances, she notes the abusive treatment. She notes the condescension, and she's furious. She can't believe that this is her mother who, you know, is telling her to clean her room and do these things, and she's being treated worse than a child, right? And she's not reacting. Her mother is just continuing to do her job. And so when they are driving back home, her mother notices how sullen she is, and she's like, okay, what's going on? And she unloads on her mother, and she says, you know, I will never be like you. What you do is terrible. And her mother did not react in anger. She reacted by being deeply hurt. Deeply hurt. And so young Estelle was able to sort of take that. She didn't have the language for it, but eventually she was able to recognize, like, oh, okay, that lady, that white woman made my mother feel, made me feel small, right? Made me feel ashamed. But the only person I can sort of react against is my mother. She's right here. I can't yell at that lady, right? That's going to get me in trouble, get my mother in trouble. Like, I can't do that, but I can be mad at her, right? And then eventually she begins to understand that the reason that she had the kind of life she did, right? That she never went hungry. She always had clothes on her back, lights on in the house. Her mother was a very hardworking, diligent, you know, single parent. She was a widow, for much of Octavia's, upbringing. And you know, the reason Octavia was able to have the life she did is because her mother endured those things, right? And so that was really a formative moment for her. And, you know, later on when she writes Kindred, it's kind of in response to that notion of internalized shame that people have. She wants to work with folks, both folks who are descendants of formerly enslaved Africans, but also folks who are of European ancestry, right? And sort of this, way in which we want to sort of forget the past or be ashamed of the past rather than reckoning with it and making sure it doesn't happen again so that we can have a better present and future.
And we are speaking with Susanna Morris about her biography, wonderful biography of Octavia Butler, Positive Obsession. You mentioned Kindred. Octavia Butler used science fiction, of course, to critique systems of racism, of power, of settler colonialism. Talk about how Kindred, which brings, by the way, just briefly, brings a modern black woman face to face with slavery. Talk about Kindred, which you deal with in a fascinating discussion in the book. It was a book that was very painful at times to write. Tell us about the difficult decisions that she made as she crafted a look at slavery and its consequences.
Yeah. So, as I just mentioned, the book is sort of catalyzed, or the catalyst for her thinking, you know, comes from wanting to having this empathy because, you know, in junior college, she had a friend who basically said, you know, black folk are not as far as we could be because we have these ancestors who were weak, right? Thinking about folks like Octavia's mother. And so Octavia always remembered that story, that conversation. And so even though she wrote three other novels before she wrote Kindred, Kindred is her fourth novel. Sometimes folks think it's her first because it's her masterpiece and, you know, her best-selling novel to date and all of that, but it was her fourth novel. And so she wanted to be armed with facts, so that despite the fact that it's a fantasy novel, right? There's no science in it. There's time travel, but there's no explanation for it. Pretty much everything else in the novel is realistic. So it's the present day setting is 1976, so the year of the bicentennial. And then they go back to antebellum Maryland, right? And so what Octavia did was take a Greyhound bus from Los Angeles and go all the way to the Eastern Shore of Maryland. And she tramped all around. She walked all around Baltimore and different parts of the Eastern Shore. She went to the Maryland Historical Society. She went to different local libraries. She went to tours, like she toured George Washington's plantation, Mount Vernon. And what she wanted to do was really... and this is in addition to all the historical research she had already done when she was at home in Los Angeles. And she had already spoken with elders in her family who weren't around during enslavement, but who knew people who had been enslaved. Like, they knew elders when they were young people who had been enslaved. And she wanted to know, okay, how did it feel like? What was it like during those times? And so all of those things together, you know, her sort of field research, right? Going to these historical societies and libraries and touching the manacles that shackled people, looking at the kind of outfits that people would wear, looking at the slave quarters, looking at Mount Vernon and being like, okay, this is how I'm going to help kind of fashion the plantation that I'm writing about. And so, yeah, she did a lot of research so that despite the fact that this is a fantasy novel where our protagonist is being whisked away and she can't kind of figure out why until she's, you know, sort of knee deep into the action of the novel, like, why am I going back in time? That is, yes, a part of it, but it's really, Octavia wanted to make the book as realistic as possible, right? And she says that she writes a sanitized version of slavery because the actual reality of slavery, it's so hard to stomach the scale and magnitude of it. And she's like, this is a novel. I want people to read it, but I want them to get the same level of truth that they would get from reading a nonfiction historical tale. So she didn't exaggerate anything, blow things out of proportion, or she showed how things really were in many types of plantations, the type of work what people would do, the way that they behaved with one another, the enslaved folk, what raising a family and being in love would be like, their relationships to white folk on the plantation, like growing up with a person who owns you, right? So then you have this complicated relationship, like, yeah, we used to play hopscotch together, and now this person can sell my spouse away. How do I interact with them?
Exactly. And there's also another aspect. I mean, not only does she kind of pull her punches on the horrors of slavery, I mean, not it's still horrific, but not as horrific as it actually was, as you say. But she also made an interesting decision about the partner of the main character. The main character is a black woman who's married to a white man, and she decided not to make him a black man, or even more refining it further, a black man who could pass for white. Say a little bit about that and how that fits into her feminist consciousness and her awareness of issues of patriarchy.
Well, Octavia was an avowed feminist throughout her life and career. And so she was certainly thinking about the gendered issues that someone would encounter during enslavement, right? So even before she settled on her protagonist, she tried to make the protagonist a man, right? And she said, okay, this person is going to be dead in 5 minutes because once his manhood is assaulted, he's going to go berserk and then he's going to be killed. But she felt like a woman would, having experience of patriarchy, not the same patriarchy of the antebellum era, but a version of patriarchy, that she would be better able to navigate because she would have had experienced multiple systems of power, multiple types of oppression. So she would be able to navigate white supremacy and patriarchy. That doesn't mean Dana makes all the right choices because she's still like a young person in 1976. So when she goes back to the 1800s, she's wearing pants, she's speaking freely, and she suffers because of those missteps, right? Octavia felt like a male protagonist was just going to be like a huge problem. Then, as you mentioned, she also toyed with different ideas, like maybe I should make her partner a black man. And then, the issue that she had around, the manhood and patriarchy and emasculation, she felt like, that's not going to work. And she also did toy with the very interesting idea of maybe making her partner a black man who could pass. But ultimately, she decided against that because she did want to have a sort of significant white character. And this was something she really thought long and hard about. She thought, are people going to think that I'm some sort of like a black man hater, or I'm fetishizing interracial relationships, or, like there's a reason why Kevin, Dana's partner, and Kindred is white. There's a moment in the novel, brief spoiler, where he goes back in time with her and he's looking around at the plantation. He's like, well, it's not as bad as I thought it would be. It's like everyone's fed and they don't have too much work to do. I mean, it's not terrible. And Dana's like, are you for real? They're enslaved. Why are you trying to make sort of make light of this or say that it's that bad, right? And so Kevin is sort of a stand-in for the white liberal in particular kinds of ways, who claims like, yeah, I'm anti-racist. Look, I'm married to a black woman. Like, I don't see color. Like, I take people as they are. And he still has these internalized notions, right, that he has to get disabused of throughout his time in the 1800s, right, and thereafter. So that combination of a white man, black woman, right, is really significant. It's also significant because in our modern era, things are different now. We see all kinds of interracial couples, but in the past, specifically before Loving versus Virginia, really, many of the black-white couples were white men and black women, and they weren't always consensual couplings, right? To be clear, even after enslavement, and so that coupling is triggering, particularly for Black folk of a certain generation. So it was also a kind of provocative coupling, right? In which she's showing like it's a caring relationship, but at the same time, Kevin is still a man, right? He still asks her to type up his manuscript, as many male authors did their wives back then, right? So there's a lot happening in terms of the intersections of racism and sexism and all those things.
And she also, as you've hinted before, Susanna Morris, she also prefigured incredibly presciently the rise of fascism, of climate collapse, and other prophecies. And so she wrote Kindred in 1976. In 1980, Reagan was elected, and she knew about Reagan because she lived in California. He'd been the governor. Talk about her prophecies about what would happen to America when Reagan was elected, prophecies that we are living today.
Right. I mean, she wrote cautionary tales, and so many of her novels that were published post Reagan, or during his administration, you know, both administrations, really are signifying on him, right? So her series, the Xenogenesis trilogy that comes out in the late 1980s, which is set in kind of post-nuclear apocalypse, is inspired by the sort of conversations that Reagan was having with the American public, saying, oh, talking about a winnable, in quotations, nuclear war, right? Which she was aghast at. She's like, there's no way to win that, right? It's going to decimate our population. It's going to damage the earth irrevocably, perhaps, and all of these things. And then Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents are also responses to Reagan because, as you mentioned, she was almost a lifelong Californian, and he had been her governor. So she had a deep abiding hatred for him. I mean, he was like her nemesis. And so, whether it was his scaling back of social programs, his approach to nuclear war and weapons, the notion of quote unquote states' rights, the dog whistles around racism. We see that pop up throughout her short story writing in the 1980s and 90s, and also in her novels. So, I know why people use the term prophecy. It makes sense. I mean, and the parable series, these have biblical titles, right? So it's inviting that kind of language. But I really prefer the language of pattern recognition, right? Octavia was an ardent student of history. He did really serious, years-long, meticulous research on every project that she wrote, right? She was often writing multiple things at the same time. And so these are cautionary tales. They're only prophecies if we don't listen to the cautionary tale, right? So we don't listen. So here we are. But she was worried about climate change. She was an environmentalist, identified as an environmentalist. And so she thought to herself, okay, I'm going to write a near future story, right? Because Parable of the Sower is published in 1993 and it's set in 2024 and beyond. He felt that it would only take about 30 years for many of these things to come to pass. And when she published a novel, folks would interview her and say, well, why are you setting it like 30 years in the future? Why not 100 years or 500 years or 1,000 years? And again, she thought, these things could happen in the 21st century. If we don't pay attention to climate change, these things could happen. If we do not get a handle on wildfires, these things will happen. We are not paying enough attention to the potential rise of fascism, right? She rejected the notion that Reagan was this like kind, grandfatherly figure who, would sit behind the desk at the Oval Office and give these, she thought this person is a sociopath. And so she felt like there could be someone, one of his successors, who could be even more maniacal. And so that's really what her prescience is about. It's her recognizing these patterns, looking at Reagan and then looking at the folks who preceded him and looking at his inspirations, looking at his contemporaries, right? So she's reading up on Margaret Thatcher. She's looking at who's in power in all these various places and what that might mean in terms of the reverberations that would happen in the decades to come. And here we are.
Yes, indeed. Here we are. I mean, it really is striking. It's striking to me, and has been for a long time, how little people understand the incredible, what I call counter-revolution of Ronald Reagan against the revolution of FDR. Although I don't know if it's really a revolution of FDR, but it was a significant response to the original Gilded Age.
For sure.
We're in the second one now. And because of this pattern recognition, she seemed to be, I don't know if I would call it, I mean, there is a dystopic element to her work, her sense that hierarchy, I mean, talk about how the human history of oppression, of others, of hierarchy operated in her work, and yet she also said that God is change, that the only actual real constant is change. So, how does that express Butler's politics of survival and adaptability within the context of how she understood some of the worst instincts of human beings operating going forward.
I mean, she was very interested in the pull of nature versus nurture. Sociobiology was a topic that she was interested in. And she had complicated notions of how human beings came to their decision. And I think that in her Xenogenesis trilogy, this was really brought to bear. She coins this term, the human contradiction. And so she argues that, and she puts it in the mouths of these aliens, right? These sort of colonizing imperialist aliens, the Oankali, who have come to Earth after this post-nuclear apocalypse. And they are like, we have to take over. Human beings are clearly immature, they have a death wish, and so we're going to fix this. And they note that human beings have this contradiction, which is we're very intelligent and we are extremely hierarchical. And rather than the hierarchy being in service to our intelligence, the intelligence is in service to the hierarchy. And that did not make sense to them because it was killing us. We would make decisions as a species that did not make logical sense, right? Simply because we did not want to share land with one group, or we were lighter than this group or darker than this group, or prayed to a different god, or had different genitalia, or whatever the thing was, whatever system it was we created did not make sense. It was not natural. It was arbitrary and it was destructive, right? And in many ways, this is how Octavia felt about racism, patriarchy, xenophobia, anti-environmentalism. Like, these things are killing us. It does not make sense. It benefits very few, yet we are committed to doing these things, right? And so even though we bill ourselves as, like, you know, the most intelligent species on the planet, we may not be. And we may not be because of the things that we do to undermine our intelligence, right? So going back to her being an environmentalist, why are we using fossil fuels at this rate when we could be harnessing solar power and wind power, but we're still using fossil fuels because a few folks can make a lot of money, right? By still using fossil fuels and not having, you know, solar powered or wind powered and other kinds of alternative energy arrangements, right? But it's really about this hierarchy within capitalism, right? And again, I think we could turn to the language of prophecy, but it's this pattern recognition that Octavia is really, that I want to really put at the forefront, right? Like, we can also be prescient. We can also pay attention if we ourselves look at the patterns, right? Of course, Octavia was a one of one talent, and not all of us can be talented. We can't all be geniuses like she was. But we can all take a look at what's happening and come to our own assessments. If we're plugged into history, if we're plugged into science, if we're plugged into the world around us, and if we have this fundamental empathy for other living creatures.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. Let's get back to my conversation with Susanna Morris about her terrific biography of Octavia Butler, Positive Obsession. Susanna Morris, you write that Octavia Butler was neurodivergent. As someone who has some neurodivergent traits myself, I know that being so brings problems for sure, but it also brings some gifts.
Exactly, exactly. And it's really, the problems come from the way that we look at intelligence, the way that we look at education. The fact that Octavia could, you know, for example, when she was writing or preparing to write the Xenogenesis trilogy, which is sort of set in both the mock Amazon river area and also the real Amazon, she thought, well, I should go to the Amazon. I should do field research in the Amazon so that my descriptions are realistic, so that the scenarios that I put my characters in make sense. That wasn't necessary. I'm so glad she did it. But she went and she joined a research group run by a professor at UCLA, and she went with them to the Amazon. She went to Peru, right? And so this is a person who was told in school that they were unintelligent, that they were lazy, that they were a daydreamer. She was none of those things, right? And many folks who are on the spectrum, folks of those of us who have ADHD and all of those things often get told, oh, you don't fit into the sort of very narrow idea of what it means to be a good student or to be a smart person or to be hardworking. Based on all we know about Octavia, she was an extremely hardworking person. Again, she valued habit over talent, right? So you have to get up every day and write. Whether you're getting published or not, you have to do your creative work. You have to be meticulous with your research. You have to take your work seriously. You know, when she mentored other writers and taught at the Clarion Writers Workshop, I mean, I went through her notes. She kept all the notes that she wrote for her students. They were very serious. I mean, she did serious line edits. This is someone who was so focused on craft, right? And I do think that she had that her neurodivergence was a gift, but it couldn't be fully realized because she lived in a world that did not recognize all of her talents.
So we haven't talked that much about Octavia Butler within the context of the Black liberation movement, and particularly her work with other Black women writers that was so important to her. How do you see her alongside Audre Lorde, Toni Morrison, other people within the canon of literature now of Black women writers?
Yeah, I love that question. Octavia was certainly part of what scholars have called the Black woman's literary renaissance, which begins in the 1970s with many of the writers that you mentioned, and I would say Maya Angelou and Alice Walker and folks like that, Toni Cade Bambara, who was a good friend of Octavia's. And so this is this explosion of literary fiction that we see happening, where we see Black women being published by everywhere from boutique small presses to, you know, major publishing houses. And this is an era where Toni Morrison is working for Random House. And here I want to shout out my colleague Dana Williams, who just wrote a really wonderful biography of Toni Morrison, Toni at Random, so her years as an editor there. So this is a really like wonderful, a prolific time for so many people. And so Octavia fits right in with her colleagues, and colleagues, and some of whom were friends. She had a collegial relationship with Toni Morrison. And for example, in the early 1980s, Butler was publishing a book called Black Futures, an edited collection that would have been of short stories, a short story anthology rather. And she reached out to Toni Morrison, and she got a polite decline. She said, I'm very busy and I don't have time to do this. Toni Cade Bambara said yes, but she was in dialogue with folks literally and figuratively. And she wrote reviews of Alice Walker's work for the Washington Post. In 1989, she went on this really fabulous retreat, the Essence Women's Writers Retreat, that was in the Bahamas. And so, I mean, there were so many wonderful writers there. So Toni Cade Bambara was there, Sonia Sanchez, Lucille Clifton. There's a wonderful picture, and I was able, gratefully, to include it in my book, of them sort of taking a group picture. And there is Octavia Butler sitting next to Lucille Clifton. So she was in community with those ladies. You know, these are Black feminist writers for the most part. They're interested in a lot of the same questions. They're just approaching them from different angles, right? So you could have a conversation about Morrison and Tozaki Shange, right, and her choreo poem for Colored Girls, and Audre Lorde and Shirley Ann Williams and all these different people, right? They're sort of thinking through questions of history, identity. They're thinking about white supremacy. They're thinking about patriarchy and sort of the double jeopardy or triple jeopardy that Black women experience. They're experimenting with craft in all kinds of different ways, right? Changing the shape of the novel and the poem and drama and all the genres that they encounter, nonfiction and fiction. And so she was certainly a part of this this cohort of folks, even though her trajectory was different in many ways, right? Many of her peers had college degrees and taught at universities, and she had an associate's degree in history. She worked many physical jobs, whereas many of her contemporaries were not doing that, right? Like her contemporaries, there was a lot of financial struggle. You know, when you talk to or look at the biographies of her contemporaries, folks were really trying to like stitch together their dollars to, you know, make their way through. So she did have that in common with them. But you know, she was also really the first Black woman to consistently publish science fiction and fantasy. She wasn't the first to do it. Even many of the authors that I just mentioned dabble in speculative fiction. Beloved is a ghost story, right? But Octavia pretty much published everything save for one short story that was speculative.
And we are speaking with Susanna Morris about her biography of Octavia Butler, Positive Obsession. And speaking of speculative fiction, she really paved the way for contemporary authors now, present authors like N.K. Jemisin, Alexis Pauline Gums. How is her legacy shaping today's Black speculative fiction and Afrofuturism?
This is language that she did not necessarily approve of. In Essence magazine in the 1990s, I believe, they called her the Grand Dame of science fiction. And she's like, oh my goodness, please don't call me that. She's very humble in some ways. And so, but yes, she is the foremother of the literary foremother of so many folks who have come after her. And folks have been very vocal about it, you know, reading Octavia and being inspired by the actual work, by her work ethic, by how she researched things. She mentored people. I spoke with several folks who were mentored by her, and they would say, you know, you could be at a party and Octavia Butler is there, and she would talk to you for any number of minutes about, like, well, what are you working on, and what's going on, and why are you doing this, and how are you doing, how is this happening? You know, folks who studied with her at Clarion talk about her being warm and kind and very exacting and having very high standards. And so she is literally and figuratively the literary mother of so many folk. And it's a really exciting time. You know, when she first started writing, it was her, Samuel Delaney, Stephen Barnes, Charles Saunders. They were like the, you know, foursome. And then over time, you started seeing more folks, Jewel Gomez, Niecy Shaw, Pananarive Due. Now, there is such a plethora, and there could always be more, but such a plethora of Black folk, Black women, and non-binary folk writing science fiction and fantasy. It's really exciting. And we have Octavia to thank for it in many ways.
Well, you know, as I hinted in my own experience, speculative fiction has been hugely influential in my life. I mentioned Woman on the Edge of Time by Marge Piercy, and the other one that was so influential to me was The Dispossessed by Ursula K. Le Guin. So, talk about, and this is something that is also a specialty of yours, so talk about the unique role of speculative fiction in allowing us to consider not just alternate futures, but alternate ways that we can interact in our lives with the world.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that Octavia felt really keenly about. You know, she and I agree with her completely in that there is something that speculative fiction does that other genres don't do in the same way. They are fundamentally forward-looking, but they're also reflections of who we are now. And so, to quote Ursula Le Guin, you know, she describes science fiction as being descriptive, not prescriptive, right? It's about us right now. So, the left hand of darkness, okay, you know, the ecumen and all that kind of stuff, but it's about 1960s America and the tensions around gender and patriarchy and all of that, right? And sexuality. And so, you get to kind of test drive different kinds of ideas, and you can set them in another setting. And sometimes that is helpful to illuminate our own experience. So, if we're talking about one of Octavia's short stories, something like Speech Sounds, which was inspired by an experience on the bus, Octavia did not drive. And so she took the bus everywhere, and she spent a lot of time just kind of looking and, you know, people watching and so on, and gave her inspiration for much of her writing. And so she saw a fight on the bus, and she saw how kind of animalistic the men were behaving and how they weren't communicating well, and they were not using their voices, they weren't speaking, they were just using physical violence to sort of interact with one another over something really small and petty, like someone stepped on someone else's shoe, something like that, right? And she extrapolates that all the way out to imagining human beings experiencing a global pandemic that kills many people. And this is published in the mid-1980s, a global pandemic that, kills and or impairs so many people. And what it takes away is our ability to speak, whether it's verbal language, sign language, body gestures. There's no shared lexicon at all. Thumbs up does not mean anything to anybody. Saying okay, or there's people can't really speak, so they're grunting, they're whimpering, they're shouting, but they're nonsensical, and no one can understand one another because that was her way of working out the fight that she saw on the bus one day when she was going to visit her friend who was dying of cancer. So she's experiencing this great loss, and then here people are being so childish in some ways, right? And that, again, that human contradiction. We're supposed to be super smart, but then here we are doing these really just basically terrible things to one another.
She died in an accident and really suddenly. So we didn't get to see how she could have looked back on the long trajectory of her life. But what were the things that she was grappling with toward the end of her life that you would have liked to have seen mature?
Well, I would have loved to see, and I know I'm not alone in this, her continue her Parable series. So she wrote two books in the series, Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents, and she wanted to write several more. So in one of the Earthseed verses, he describes God as trickster, teacher, clay, chaos, all these different aspects. And so she wanted to write novels with those things in mind, right? That were set years after Lauren Olamina and all of that. And she just had really severe writer's block. When her mother died in 1996, she went through a really serious bout of depression, and it was hard for her to write. So she wrote, but she wasn't satisfied with what she wrote. So I would have loved to see more of her Parable series published. There are segments and scraps and, fragments of it in her archive. And I would also love to see more of Fledgling, of the series that it seemed like it was going to be a series, right? And there are sequel type materials in her archive. So, yeah, I think that if she had not died so young at 58, there would be so many more wonderful works that we would be able to read. But we still have 12 that we can engage with, 12 books, right? And one book is a collection of short stories and short writing. So there's, she left us with an amazing treasure trove.
And one that I am determined to dive into after reading this really inspiring and wonderful biography of her, Susanna Morris. The book is Positive Obsession: The Life and Times of Octavia E. Butler. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you for having me.
Susanna M. Morris is a Black feminist, Afrofuturist writer, scholar, and cultural critic. She's an associate professor of literature, media, and communication at Georgia Tech and co-founder of the Crunk Feminist Collective. We have a few minutes left, so let's listen to a short clip from my 2012 conversation with sci-fi great Ursula K. Le Guin. We spoke on the occasion of the publication of her two-volume short story retrospective, The Unreal and the Real. Now, there's an other story in this collection, again in volume two, and this one also, I think, is in the Haynes cycle. It's The Matter of Segre. And we're talking with Ursula K. Le Guin about her new collection of stories, a new book, two volumes, The Unreal and the Real. Volume one is Where on Earth? Volume two is Outer Space, Inner Lands. And in that second volume, The Matter of Segre, you said something before about how you like to turn things on their head. And this one also very much turns things on their head. It's about a society in which women have all the power, but none of the glory, and men have all the glory, but none of the power.
That is a kind of a, that is a sort of classically science fictional story in its origin. It is, you know, a bit of a puzzle why there are as many men as there are women, or why there are as many female cats as there are, I mean, as many male cats as there are female cats, because you don't need that many males to keep the females reproducing. Look at your average flock of chickens. There's one rooster and 20 hens, right?
Yeah.
That is, and that works fine. So why are there so many males? And it actually is not a question that has a definite answer given by science. So I just imagined a world where that, for whatever reason, that proportion didn't hold, and that males are quite rare and therefore extremely valued. And yet they're not enough of them to dominate the society the way they dominate, as far as we know, all extant Earth societies. So what would you get if you had a society where there was maybe one male child grew to adulthood? So how would, well, of course, you can think of 100 ways they might handle that, but so I just thought of one and made a rather grim set of little short stories about it.
You also deal with the issue, though, of identity, you know, gender identity versus individual identity in this story, something you take up in another story as well, although not from the gender point of view. That story's Nine Lives. I'll just quote from one of the characters in The Matter of Segre. This is after this society has been contacted by the Ecumen, is that how?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
By the Ecumen, this confederation of planets. They have been contacted. They know their society is in some ways unusual. And this character says, maybe in a few more decades we'll decide we should remake ourselves. In other words, we should genetically engineer us so that we have a more equal balance between the sexes. But she says she doesn't want to be alive then. She likes our people, our fierce, proud, beautiful men. I don't want them to become like women. I like our trustful, powerful, generous women. I don't want them to become like men. And yet I see that among you, that is the others from the Ecumen, each man has his own being and nature. Each woman has hers. This is a very interesting counterpoint between how we structure identity as an individual and as part of the group.
Good, because that's exactly what I wanted it to be. In a sense, I've tried in various ways to kind of shake up our fixed belief that there is a gender identity and that it is kind of eternal and God-given and must not be changed and so on. Since, I mean, any study of anthropology can tell you that gender is constructed rather differently in different places, even on Earth. And since gender is not constructed very well in our society in many ways, it's very hard. I think it's unnecessarily hard both on men and on women. As a fiction writer, I enjoy just shaking up the mixture and finding what comes out.
I told Ursula K. Le Guin that one of the stories that most surprised and delighted me was about a being that seemed very much like a mouse in a laboratory.
A rather small alien being who is, unfortunately, has a very highly specialized diet, kind of like our koala bears do. You know, koalas can only eat eucalyptus, which in the long run is not a very good idea for the survival of the species. It's a first contact story, to use the science fictional technical term, you know, when a first contact between Earth people and some other species. And so the scientist who is studying this rather small alien treats it may resemble something a bit mouse-like, because he treats it kind of like a little rodent, puts it in a maze. And he gives it the right kind of food, but unfortunately the food is dead. The animal can live only on living food. which is also true of certain earth organisms. But of course, you know, in the larger sense, Francesca, it sort of is a mouse. I'm putting the reader into the point of view of a mouse in a scientist's laboratory.
Right. And this mouse, I mean, the maze is a whole marvelous construct that is religious and spiritual and intellectual and social for the mouse. You know, I just love to read something about it. For example, he says the second maze was a kind of simple version of the ungated affirmation, quite adequate for the reassuring, outreaching statement I wanted to make. I mean, it's just lovely to conceive of the maze as a kind of language and construct.
Yeah, now, you see, that came to me from my little space alien mouse when I began communicating through fiction with it, that these people, and they are people because this is obviously a highly intelligent creature, they communicate through dance. Their language is dance, and that is what the poor scientist who's totally verbally fixated, the language is has to be verbal, you know, he cannot see that the little alien is wildly attempting to communicate, and the Earth scientist is attempting to communicate with the alien because it sort of intuits there's some intelligence here, but I don't get it. Both of them, one dies of frustration. The other just ends up kind of brokenhearted. He never could figure out his little creature.
Yeah, he tries to deal with the creature through a kind of Skinnerian, you know, pushing the levers to get food or an electrical charge.
Let's hope when we really do meet some space aliens that we're not stuck in that kind of mechanical version of communication.
And so I'm going to come back to my first question somewhere along in the beginning, where you say we need to have a new discourse on fiction. What would that new discourse be if you were, you know, emceeing the conversation?
Well, coming from where I come from, I would like critics and teachers, academic particularly, to sort of get over modernism and the idea that the only good fiction is realistic. It never was true, and it's getting less and less true now. Realism, as we know it, is not really capable of handling some of the realities that we live in now.
What do you mean?
Well, just what I say, that I think realistic fiction, as we've conceived it, which is increasingly, at least in this country, coming down to the unhappinesses of dysfunctional suburban families, that is a very narrow approach to existence, and it's been pretty well worked over. And I think the interesting writing that's being done is way off on other margins and edges of what was considered central to fiction.
That was the late, great Ursula K. Le Guin talking with me in 2012. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests. You can find our social media links there, too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.